Welcome, and this is our fourth session of five sessions on the entire Bible. And today we'll be looking at the, dealing with the Jesus story. But first, anything from yesterday, I think our discussion at the end yesterday is one of the deepest and the hardest discussions that the church needs to be involved in, and we need to be involved in, and that is the question of God. We had Terry Fretheim from Luther Northwestern speaking at PLU, and he says, while pastors tend to be talking about almost everything else, the main question of lay people is God, especially in relation to all of the suffering and all of the tragedy in life. You know, and it's really the question we were moving towards. And so I'll present the Jesus story, but just feel free to keep bringing up questions about that. Yeah. Is there one thing I need from our talking that I needed to clarify? Something I said about the crucifixion or something I'm trying to remember?
Oh, it was expressed in terms of that was a failure on God's part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I needed to clarify that when I said the crucifixion or Jesus dying on the cross was kind of the ultimate example of God's power being the opposite of what we would call human success or human power or all of our definitions of power. It was really giving up of all power. You know, in a way it was God choosing failure by our definitions of failure. Well, I'd like to begin with this verse from Micah, the prophet Micah, where part of these times when the prophets were preaching, they also dreamed. And growing up, I think we kind of narrowed the word prophet down to just someone who tells the future. And the more you read in the Bible, you find out their main occupation was proclaiming the word of God in their times, about their times. But then they would go off and dream about if God could be so wonderful for us in the past, think of the future that God has in store for us. And one of these is Micah 4. But in the days to come, Yahweh's temple mountain will tower above the mountains, rise higher than the hills. Then the peoples will stream to it. Micah is just picturing all the nations coming to Jerusalem. And they will come and say, we will go up to Yahweh's mountain, to the temple of the God of Jacob, so that he may teach us his ways and we may walk in his paths. For the law issues from Zion and Yahweh's word from Jerusalem. The nations will be so impressed by a people living the manna way that they'll just come and say, give us lessons. You know, we'd like to learn this way. And then it goes into the beautiful words about hammering swords into plowshares, nations living in peace, and everyone enjoying their nahalah, the vine and the fig tree, with no one to trouble, a time of security. This is the vision of God's future. And I wanted to read that as a background today of the Jesus story. The first part of sharing today, I want to just very briefly share about what the time was like when Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Part of the reason for this, I think many of us grew up with like Sunday school pictures on the wall that made it look Palestine at the time of Jesus look so serene. I mentioned the other day in class we had this Augsburg manger scene that came in a box this size. Did anybody else have that? And ours was the deluxe model where one of your Christmas tree lights could come down and go through this hole and illuminate Mary, Joseph, and the baby. And I mentioned it the other day because one of the wise men was black, and I remember as a little kid just being so awestruck, you know, by that figure. But also, if you remember, there were two scenes on either side of the manger scene that you pulled out the little tab on the back so they would stand up. And I remember looking, and it just made Palestine look so serene. gardens and trees and flowers and just mine. And then, so in do you know what I mean? We kind of grew up with this image. Now, I'd like to just share briefly what the time was like at the time of Jesus. A comparison would be if you were a Native American in the year 1400, 1500, just before the European invasion, you know, life would be fairly normal. And there were some tribal warfare, and but life would pretty much go on generation by generation by generation. And there were all the rituals, the shamans, all of the traditions to kind of hold life together. And then I always imagine the 20 years before the first European comes, they still think this is the way it will always be. And then think of the crumbling of society then with the European invasion. And if you can begin to feel that, you can begin to feel what Judaism was like when Jesus was born. It was a nation in crisis. It was a nation of a way of life crumbling. And I want to spend a few minutes at the beginning to just show how that crisis was happening. The pressure came from two places. One was the Roman occupation, and it was especially the Roman tax system. And then coupled with that was the invasion of Greek Roman culture. And it's so close to the world today, where so many old societies in the world with television, radio, all the media are being invaded by American culture. Have you ever heard how that happens in old societies? You know, but Greek Roman culture was pressing in, and the Roman taxation system. Okay, now, what this taxation system was doing is that one, the elites, the wealthy elites of the Jewish community worked with the Romans in exploiting the poor. And then this is what happened was you had a very, very heavy Roman tax. And then this was coupled with a Jewish tithe, which would be between the two of them, if you were a poor farmer, this temple tax and the Roman tax would be up to over 50% of your crops and your income. And then added on to that, you would have to pay the tax collectors that collected the tax. And then if you went and traveled any place, there were tolls all the way around. So the taxation burden was just incredible. And what it did was it broke families up, because it resulted in thousands and thousands of families losing their nahala, their family farm. And then their children would have to go off to cities around the world to try to find work. And so family structure was broken up. But then here's what many, many families had to do in order to keep their house, land, and little farm together. Was if you paid both of the taxes, you would go under in a horrendous debt. So you would choose to pay one of the taxes. Now, if you were a farmer at that time, which tax would be easier to get out of?
The temple tax.
Yeah, the temple tax, because there wasn't the Roman army and the Roman police and the Roman to come and arrest you and take you away. So many, many Jewish families chose not to pay the Jewish tithe to the temple. Okay, then the response to Greek-Roman culture was for the Jewish community to really pull itself into what would be called pure Judaism, according to their interpretation. And this was to take all of the laws, especially the purity codes, the washing, the cleaning, the way you eat, the way you and plus keeping the Sabbath and all the rules about Sabbath, the community pulled itself in to keep all of these purity rules in order to kind of keep away the Greek-Roman cultural invasion. And then one of the main purity rules was the tithe. So then the family that chooses not to pay the tithe in order to keep their lamb then is considered a non-observant Jew. And very likely when the Bible says that Jesus ate with tax collectors and sinners, a large part of the group of people called sinners were these poor people who had chosen not to pay the temple tithe in order to keep their land and hold their land together. And then many who chose to pay their tithe in order to be pure Jews then would lose their land. And then by losing your land, then you were a day laborer. And then socially, you were kind of outside of Judaism anyway, because it was so based on kind of land ownership. So either way, the poor people were just desperately either without food, without land, or without any respect or decency in the community of purity. So on top of this was militarism was rampant. Because what was the solution? It had been the solutions that the Maccabeans did against the Greeks. And now it is only a matter of time when we will all get together with their swords again and drive out the Romans. And the Romans were hated.
Don't you think that's going on today?
A lot of
people are losing their homes because they can't
finish paying. So when Jesus in the Lord's Prayer, "Forgive us our debt as we forgive those who are in debt to us," he was teaching prayer in the midst of a debt-ridden society. A society of poor people who were drowning in debt because of the Roman taxation system. And the very means they had of maybe escaping the debt would lead them into becoming a non-observant Jew and considered an outsider and a sinner. But basically, if you were poor and the average people just didn't have a chance, and the anger that they held, it was a seething anger and the desperation. And you can see how, again, it's a time when for many of them, all that was left was to cry out to God for liberation. Will God act again to liberate us in the midst of this desperate situation? Well,
you said as sinners. Do they call people they don't like as sinners?
Well, it was a category because Jesus was accused of eating with tax collectors. These are the ones that did the tax farming for the Roman Empire. You can have some idea what people thought of them. And then Jesus also ate with sinners, which would have included the bottom people, including like prostitutes and extortioners and people who had resorted to crime because of their desperate debt situation. And it also included sinners, was a category that included the people who had chose not to pay their temple tithe in order to keep their land and try to hold their land and their family together. And those who were considered pure and had pulled themselves in, and in a way, if you were rich, you could be pure. You kind of went together. You could afford to be pure. These people had one way, major, major way of telling people who were below the line that they were below the line, and that was to refuse table fellowship. That was a major way of telling someone that they were outside of approved Judaism, was to deny table fellowship and refuse, and it might be the neighbor down the road, might be the neighbor across, and somehow you were able to stay within the pure people. The way you would tell them that they were outside was to not eat with them. Well, this is a situation to which Jesus comes. And now picture First John the Baptist in the situation in Luke's gospel. John the Baptist preaches this very wonderful sermon, like, "You brood of vipers." And notice John calls them out. Where does John preach? Yeah, the desert, the wilderness. And then there's water there, and people go through the water. And all the images now are, come to the wilderness and we'll begin again. And we're going to start all over as a people. And going through the water of John's baptism is a way of saying, we'll go through the Red Sea or the Reed Sea again. That's how we'll be ready for the Messiah. Come to the wilderness. And where there's a wilderness, there's a classroom. Remember, there's always a classroom in the wilderness. And now John is a teacher in the wilderness, and the people that respond to his sermon say, what shall we do? And in Luke, in Luke 3, here is John's answer. And notice how this fits into the wilderness mentality and also the manna way. Well, I'll just paraphrase it. I don't need to read it. But he simply says, if you have two coats and somebody has none, give the extra one away. And if it's food, do the same. And tax collectors, don't charge, overcharge. And soldiers, stop practicing extortion and be satisfied with your wages. Now notice how do you get ready for the Messiah, but enter again the wilderness mentality. If you have two coats, that's like excess manna, right? And if there's one who has none, you balance. It's all a matter of balance. And then John would say, now in the wilderness, you're ready. You're ready for the Messiah. Then when Jesus comes, he goes to the synagogue at Nazareth. Remember, and he preaches, some have called it his inaugural address. And he reads Isaiah and says, behold, I have come to bring good news to the poor. Okay. Now I'll ask you, looking at this situation, and someone came as a rabbi and said, I have come to bring good news to the poor. What would that mean? How would you?
Going to overthrow Rome.
But, you know, we'll somehow overthrow the system. Somehow we'll get our land back.
It took a Greek to do that.
Yeah. We'll get our land back. There'll be land reform. And Jesus ends his inaugural address, or the Isaiah part of it, by saying, I have come to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Acceptable year of the Lord. Which in their minds meant the Jubilee year. Do you remember what we, this is a little test or a review, quick quiz. What happened in the Jubilee year?
The land was given back.
All the land that had been lost was given back. Imagine this rabbi comes and says, I've come to proclaim that the Jubilee year is here. If you've lost your land, then every day you go and line up for day labor in order to get a few little shekels to buy some food for your family tomorrow. And here is this prophet, this rabbi, who says, I have come to proclaim Jubilee. Could you imagine? You'd be a little excited. But then after the sermon of Jesus, they tried to throw him off a cliff. Well, at least he got a reaction. And that was because he hinted that this Jubilee year was also for the Gentiles. Think of this, pure Judaism, the background of throwing out the foreign wives and thinking this is right. Jesus says this is going to be for Gentiles too. And then Jesus goes forth in his ministry of healing, and forgiving, and casting out demons, and eating, and eating, and eating, and eating. And then Jesus eats some more, and then he's eating some more, and then he's eating, and eating, and eating. Do you get the point? Food. Food. Wherever Jesus is, there's food. And think of the ways that Jesus shared food. And what did they call him? Unlike John the Baptist, who had used some restraint, what did they call Jesus?
Glutton and drunkard.
A glutton and a drunkard. And his food sharing number one, he had, in Luke, we know he had wealthy women disciples that were with him. And no doubt they bought food and threw big banquets for the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. He called the rich to invite the poor, maimed, lame, and blind to eat at table. It's a way of saying, let's have a man of society. Let's have the wilderness again. And then the feeding of the 5,000. Here is the wilderness. Here is the manna. And everyone receives. Did you notice Jesus did not send the disciples around to check who was worthy? Or who was old enough to understand? You get it? And it was abundant bread for all. It was the wilderness. And then on his way to Jerusalem. But before I say that, the offense of Jesus was not all of his eating, but with whom did he share food?
Tax collectors and sinners.
And tax collectors and sinners. And they murmured. I love that word in the New Testament. Murmur, 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 murmur. Think of we who are into religion and organized religion, how much murmuring we do. Never thought of that. Murmur, murmur, murmur. God's grace is too abundant. You know, tax collectors and sinners meant that in relation to pure Judaism, Jesus was going way beyond, below the line of unacceptability. And the New Testament loves this. The New Testament writers love this. So what was one of the most unacceptable people were shepherds. You know, why? You know, how could you stay pure and keep all of the eating rules and the cleansing rules and the not being near dead body rules if you're a shepherd? For they're the utter despised outcasts. You know? And Luke has this fun of bringing forth the angel choir, the first time they have sang since the creation of the world, according to Jewish belief. And that's a long practice session. And when the angel choir comes together for the second time after the creation of the world, for whom do they sing? Shepherds. Shepherds. And we get to the book of Acts, and Luke there has fun having Peter eating with Simon the tanner. You know, here's this man that deals with dead bodies. What's that? That works with dead bodies all the time. These are the unacceptable. Jesus eats with them. Isn't this, think of the grace that came from Jesus feeding. Now, I want to just share one of the stories, which in Luke is very close to when Jesus enters Jerusalem to suffer and to die, and that is when Jesus is going through Jericho, and he looks up into this tree, and who's up in the tree? Zacchaeus. Who learned the song in Sunday school? Oh, good, we can sing it. Zacchaeus was a wee little man, a wee little man was he. He climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. And as the Savior cast that way, he looked up in the tree. And he said, Zacchaeus, you come down. For I'm going to your house today. For I'm going to your house today. I can tell we had different traditions. Mine was a Swedish Augustana Sunday school tradition. Karen grew up in the Missouri Synod and they never sang any of these songs. She was totally knew none of these songs. Right? But why did we go like this when we had Jesus telling him to come out of the tree? You know, it should have been, whatever it was.
burn.
It's on church.
But here's Zacchaeus, and he truly was up in a tree. He was a collaborator with the Romans, and he was wealthy because he was a tax farmer. And I remember Karen has relatives in Norway, and one of our first trips there in the late 60s, we met with one of her relatives who was a collaborator during the war and housed Nazi officers in her home. And do you think the other relatives liked her? And they still, this was the late 60s, they still were not speaking to her. And she was still totally outcast. So it gives you an idea of how they would have felt about Zacchaeus. And so Jesus says, I'm going to your house, which in Jewish times meant eating. Now you'd never have somebody in your house without eating. And they break bread, and houses were rather public. At the windows, you would have people just standing and looking in. And did they murmur? Did they murmur? And this was unconditional grace. Notice Jesus does not say when he looks up into the tree, Zacchaeus, if you promise to shave up a little, I'll come to your house. Or if you'll make a few commitments on improving your life, I'll come to your house. But it's simply, I'm going to eat with you. And this unconditional grace converts Zacchaeus to the wilderness mind. Or he cannot wait to jump up from the table and start a manna redistribution program. Half of everything I have, I'll give to the poor. If I've cheated anybody, people would say, if I'll restore fourfold, four times. It's balance, it's equality. And Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. There's a word we've blown. Salvation. Are you saved? In America, it means when you die, will you go to heaven? Salvation has come to this house because this household has become a manna community. Now, some say that this story in Luke is just before Jesus goes to die on the cross, to Jerusalem to die. As a way of saying the very reason he dies on the cross is to woo the whole world to be a Zacchaeus society, to be a Zacchaeus world. And Jesus goes to Jerusalem and there, before the crucifixion, shares a meal with his disciples. And I don't want to do too much advertising of my little picture book, but if there's one reason to buy it, is for the picture of the Last Supper, because it includes women. And have you ever looked at a Last Supper picture like Da Vinci's and it looks like a men's club? There's scholarship that shows in Luke's Gospel there were women at the Last Supper. And here bread is shared, a manna meal for them and for all the disciples of all time. And if you thought, we still in a way get it a little, that every time we share Holy Communion, I'll ask this question, is there any congregation here that anybody is from that has big super wafers for important people? And little wafers for ordinary people? You notice how we don't even know it, but we are entering into a different world, and we intuitively know that it will be something very wrong about that, because it is still a deep sense, although we haven't taught this for 500 years, maybe, we have a deep sense that this is a manna wilderness meal. And every time we share Holy Communion, we are sharing the dream, God's dream for the whole world. And here, Presbyterian, do you have little squares?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cubes.
Cubes, yeah. Yeah. That's the main difference between Lutherans and Presbyterians.
Very square.
That's right. squares and cubes. And I, so I'm gonna ask you, do you have big cubes for it, for yours? Then I have to say, this is the whole thing about the wafers. We often use a, I remember a priest saying, it takes two great acts of faith to receive this. First, you have to believe that it's bread. And secondly, you believe it's the body of Christ. Or another was a pastor I knew who went to convalescent home to share communion, and it was a home where they did reality therapy, and you always knew the date and your name. And so he held this wafer up, and the woman said, "It is May 20, 2019, so my name is, I am living in, and I don't eat paper." This world that Jesus brought to his people, this world of abundant grace for all, it was just too much for the powers who all benefited by the way things were. The powers, the elites, the big deals.
Which is not unlike today.
Yes. When a whole new reality enters in, it comes as threat. So the only answer was to get rid of him. And the vote was to get rid of him. They crucified him, nailed him to a cross. And in the little booklet, I have the big deals having a cocktail party that day, because they're saying, thank God things are back to normal. Normal is good for us and for the nation. Thankfully, things are back to normal as Jesus dies on the cross. And the poor who followed Jesus and hoped he would be the one to restore the wilderness man of society are in despair. As the disciples on the road to Emmaus said, we had hoped he would be the one. And now all is lost. And I guess the only way the world can ever be is the oppressed and the oppressors, the big deal elites, and the poor in poverty and hunger and desperation. The only way the world can be is people who are unworthy, rejected, who are considered totally worthless, while others are the good people. That's the only way the world can ever be. We had hoped that things might be different, but the vote was in, and Jesus dying on the cross, the vote was no. But before he died from the cross, and Luke has a beautiful way of picturing the crucifixion, and this is the strange world of the Gospels. It's where everything is turned upside down. And Luke portrays the crucifixion as a strange king on a throne in a courtroom or a kingly palace. And Jesus on the cross is a king on a throne. And what does a king do on a throne but issue imperial decrees? And there Jesus does in their decrees of manna and decrees of mercy. To the thief on the other cross, today we are going to be sharing the great banquet of paradise. Nobody would have ever thought of paradise without abundant food. And Jesus says, today we're going to share with this person of the lowest worth of all. And then he looks out at all who have crucified him and says, mercy, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And the way of the covenant of ancient Israel, the way of righteousness and compassion, is decreed from the strange throne, which is the cross. And Jesus dies. And all is lost, because all the votes are in and the votes are null. But one vote had not been counted yet. That was Yahweh Sabaoth. Yahweh, the Lord God, who reached into that tomb and said yes. And Jesus rose from the dead. And I like the phrase, Jesus and his troublemaking go merrily on. And I like to think Jesus came out of the tomb and said, let's eat. Let's get on with the dinner parties. Let's get on with receiving those who are worthless. Let's get on with sharing food, the kingdom of God. And that will, tomorrow we'll go from the resurrection then to the early church. But I want to just remind you again that the first witnesses of the resurrection were the women, and most of them were named Miriam, who now announced that he is raised from the dead. Oh, well, that's the sharing of the Jesus story in a way that shows how Jesus was a continuation of the wilderness, the man of society, that in a way he didn't bring something. Jesus was completely new, but at the same time didn't bring something completely new, but a restoration of the wilderness, and finally a calling now of the whole world into a wilderness community. Well, I can stop there. Let's just, how do I say this? What would you like to talk about?
I was dancing. I was thinking of the significance of the other two on the cross. Is there studies of both the two, or the reason there were only two besides?
I'm just guessing.
There's some significance to that. Or
Yeah, most likely, I don't know about the significance of two. I would think it would be the day we kind of quoted, the people that were up for that day. Yeah. So I don't know any other significance of it. What I do know is probably the reason the other two were on the cross, and also the reason Jesus was on the cross, is that the Roman Empire had two ways of deterrence, against any type of rebellion against the Roman occupation. And the first was crucifixion. Now, anybody that could be proven to be part of the resistance movement. And they were called robbers, I think. It's called the thief on the cross. And what the resistance movement did in Palestine at the time of Jesus is that they weren't powerful enough, at least this is the latest reading I've done, they were not powerful enough at that time to directly attack the Roman armies. They were up in the hills. They also hid in the temple because Romans weren't allowed in the temple as part of their respect for Jewish religion. But they also hid up in the hills, and when one was caught, that one was crucified. That was a way of keeping people out of. Then this movement developed, so later it became zealot armies that actually attacked the Romans until the major war, Jewish-Roman war, broke out in the 60s. But at this time, they mainly robbed and pillaged, is that the word, pillaged?
Mm-hmm.
Or they, wealthy Jewish estates, which were the Jewish people. In the New Testament, we meet them as the Sadducees. And they're the ones that had taken land away from the poor people and added it to their land to have large estates. And the zealots would probably raid them and kill them and attack them. So that's why they would be called thieves and robbers. And so very likely the two dying on the cross were revolutionaries, the kind of early revolutionaries against the Roman occupation. And then the Romans crucified thousands of them. Not hundreds, but thousands of them. And it was also a way of keeping the slave system intact, that any slave that was accused of any kind of rebellion against the master would be crucified. So that was kind of the first front of the Roman deterrent system. The second was to level a city to the ground. And if there was too much rebellion in a city, you would just either massacre the city or carry them all off into slavery and then totally, totally level the city to the ground. And to the Roman, it was very important that finally there just be a flat, rocky surface where this city had been, to be a sign to all the other cities of the Roman Empire that this is what happens if you rebel. So that was, so again, it shows these were not normal times. So that's, I know that's kind of a long answer, but that's probably what the two were that were crucified with Jesus. And
you know, the thing you were saying just brings back the picture that I see in the movie, in the TV, of what's going on in Europe now.
Yeah.
And they're doing the same thing, bombing houses, people, killing people. For what? I just don't feel that they have gained anything. They're not any better.
The Jewish people this time had the memory of where warfare had worked. You know, that's when it's hardest to question militarism. You know, when it has worked, and it had during the Maccabean uprising against the Greeks. So it was the major mentality, and it also gives you an idea how popular Jesus was coming there and saying, "Love your enemy. If your enemy chooses to strike you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. If the Roman soldier asks you to go 1 mile, go 2 miles." Jesus had a whole new way of relating to the Romans. And that's what enemy would have been. And it was a way of winning them over in a way that was very different, but it was another form of power. I love some of this, like Jesus saying, walk the second mile. In the context of these times, a Jewish person, they were the luggage carriers for the Roman occupation, and you had to carry all the arms. When the Romans moved from one place to the other, Jewish people carried all their supplies. But the civil right was that you only had to do it for 1 mile. Then you'd find some more Jewish people to carry it the next mile, and then they would drop it, and then you would carry it the next mile. And Jewish people hated this. This was a symbol of their oppression, and when they had to carry this stuff, they would look the other way and scowl and frown and feel terribly humiliated, and they knew exactly when the mile was up, and they would run. You know, Jesus says, well, why don't you start moving into the second mile? And the Jewish people had an old saying, if you walk with somebody long enough, you'll become friends. And Jesus was saying, this Pinchas Lapide, the Orthodox Jewish New Testament scholar, he said what Jesus was teaching them to do was to surprise the astonished Roman soldier with anticipatory grace. The Roman soldier would just say, what is this? But the Jewish person walking alongside is walking there in pride and dignity and conversation and receiving. You see, now we're talking about another form of power. Mm-hmm. And it's the power of the cross.
I'm also thinking about pride. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes maybe walking, carrying is work. It's physically tiring, but there's something more important. It's their pride that hurt them more than the carrying of the luggage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think maybe Jesus was teaching Jewish people to carry this with the dignity of Mahalia Jackson walking with Martin Luther King in the Civil Rights March, as people were spitting on her, you know, with this dignity that it actually would convert people. Your hand up.
I have the same problem I had yesterday. It seems to me that God is just not organized and strong enough. That it's so pitiful, and it's just a few people, and they're just sort of struggling along and having these little methods, counter-revolutionary, revolutionary methods, walking the second mile, converts a few people, but the power structure, the dominant structure, remains there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the power structure, they can only be powerful if people let them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. But they're, one opinion I have that I just, it's always, it always comes back to us and what are we about. But, the early Christian movement was really kind of, was really moving throughout the whole world. You know, these communities of peace that were certainly not perfect, but, and the Romans tried to stop them, you know, with persecution, and that didn't work. And finally, the Romans thought of the perfect method, and that was to give them property. That's basically what happened in the 4th century. These counterculture Christian communities were given property by the Romans. We'll give you land, we'll give you church buildings, we'll give you structures. And then once you have structures, then you adopt the Roman army to help protect you. And then you're enculturated. And then it's over. The Romans were very smart. And it's been a, it's a, and that was called the Constantinian, some would say the destruction of the movement. Because some would say that until Constantine, the Christian church had a definite understanding that it was a counterculture that was to live a different way of life than the rest of the world as a way of attracting the rest of the world into a new way of living, which was bread sharing and nonviolence. And the Romans did a great job. And now we've lived in the Constantinian age ever since. And
of acquiring material possessions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
that doesn't, the deeper question is God just kind of pitiable in these kind of attempts that never work? That's your, I was avoiding the harder question. You know, and it just, it's amazing. I mean, I don't know what to say about that. It just, it seems like throughout the world there are little pockets or little bubbles, I like to say. Christians are very vulnerable, and the Jewish people who say that Jesus is not the Messiah, it's their best argument. You know, took a confirmation class to a Jewish synagogue, and one of our brighter students who always asked the brightest questions, you know, and I was kind of saying, I wish you wouldn't be asking that one. You know, why don't you believe Jesus is the Messiah, the 8th grader? Nothing happened. You know, Jewish people believe when the Messiah comes, there will be a world of peace. Nothing really happened. You know, and I didn't have, you know, what else, what could I say? You know, this is, and it's a very sincere Jewish argument.
Another side of that, a Jewish rabbi friend of mine said, I like what I read in the New Testament. The only problem I have is I don't see much similarity between the Christians and the New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me of some friend in Tacoma who had served in China, was teaching English in China, and a Chinese student in this university read the New Testament for the first time in his life, you know, and read about Jesus' teachings about nonviolence, and he was so excited to meet Christians who followed this way. He just immediately assumed that every Christian followed the New Testament, and the what if, and then it raises, what if we did?
Mm-hmm.
What if we did?
I think Americans are very intermixed in not only their background, their belief, but how they approach things that are different from themselves. And not realizing that people who are different sometimes, if you listen and think, you find out that maybe they've got something to offer. If you'd be willing to open your mind and your heart and your ears, yeah, we could gain by it, not fight about it, or, you know, criticize, or, you know.
Well, it's what Jesus meant in his teaching about love your enemy.
Love your enemy?
Yeah. Because an enemy is basically one you don't care to understand because you've dehumanized. You've decided they're somewhat less than human. There's nothing to learn from them. And the difference between that and love.
I can only hear about half what you said. Oh. So
well, it wasn't real profound. I said it's what, when Jesus said love your enemy, part of it was what you said, it was to listen to them and their human beings that have something.
Just because people are different, that don't make them your enemy.
Right. Go ahead. Amen.
I think one of the gifts that you've given me this week is to cause me to question my really hazy perception of God in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It would be helpful to me if you would maybe share. I appreciate it if you would share your thoughts about, who and what is God?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 50 words or less.
If I could go back to this chart, I think it's really, it might speak to that, because a lot of this material has come from a beautiful little book, and I say little because it's brief and easy to read. Now, if you're afraid of massive theological, biblical, scholarly things, but it's called Jesus, A New Vision by Marcus Borg, and Marcus Borg teaches religion at Oregon State, and part of it is I love to read a scholarly book that comes out of Oregon and not Yale or Harvard.
Oregon's places.
But one thing he states that maybe a major, major reason that Jesus was crucified was because of his God image. That he went to the Old Testament and had a different God image than the majority God image of the people. And the God image of the mind makers of that time were the Pharisees. I mean, they were not a majority group, but they were a powerful group in kind of setting the way everybody thought. And to them, the very heart and center of God was purity. God was on God's throne, and the heart of God was purity. And the only thing God could tolerate in human beings was purity. And the task of humans was to be ritually and morally pure in order to be God's people. You know, and the Pharisees were deeply serious. I mean, we've tended to give them the bad name, but following their God image, they had a passion to make Israel pure because God is pure, and that is the heart of God. And anything that is ritually or morally impure, is far from the heart of God. And in Luke's gospel, Jesus says in his teaching, Jesus says in his teaching, be compassionate as your Father in heaven is compassionate. And to Jesus, he really changed the center of the heart of God. In other words, the throbbing center of the mystery of the whole universe is one of just passionate love and compassion. And the teaching of Jesus was the invitation in his demonstration of what compassion means. And when it takes place, when the God image of compassion takes place in a society of people, it is very radical. Because, and the belief is that we act according to our God image. You know, and this is so, and feminist scholars and feminist theologians have helped us. I mean, what is our problem as a society? It isn't that we don't have quite the right laws or the right structures or what, but our God image is one of male authoritarianism. And when that is our God image, then the more male and the more authoritarian you are, the closer you are to the heart of God. Just as there the people who were the most pure were the closest to the heart of God. For us it has been the God on the throne, and below God are the people who are in power. And God is male, God is white. And then the farther on down the line you are, the less acceptable you are. You get down to women, and then you get down to children, and then you get down to animals, and if you're a rock, you're really in trouble. And it is a feminist, our feminist, I was going to say our feminist brothers and sisters. Which I guess is true, because we men are feminists if we share this mentality, but it's been feminists who have challenged us with our God image.
What did you give as the name of that book?
Marcus Borg, Jesus, A New Vision. It's in the bookstore. Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say that Jesus restored the God image of the prophets in a time that was dominated by the priests?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the prophets lived in real conflict in many ways with the priests. Because to the prophets, the God image was Hesed. H-E-S-E-D. To the priest, the God image was purity. Hesed is the word for the Bible most translates loving kindness. The whole world is different, I think, and our whole lives are different according to our image of what God is. And even today, Jesus' God image is one of compassion that would make all the difference in how we live together and how we would structure ourselves and relate. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I guess maybe you've been helpful in terms of the idea of a God image. Maybe I'm the only one that's struggling with that, but I need a lot of work on that, because that's something I'm, mm-hmm. these sessions have shaken that a bit. Perhaps needed to be shaken.
And that it is, I think there's a way when we encounter Jesus and truly encounter Jesus in the Gospels, the deepest level at which Jesus would challenge us is, do we have an American God? Do we have a male authoritarian God? You know, do we have a God that needs to be replaced? Some have said the major message of Jesus was idolatry. You know, it's what he would see as false God images.
I think people are influenced by artwork that has been done a long time ago, 100 years ago, but that's the way the artist pictures them, and then people say, oh, that's it, this is it, you know, mm-hmm. they accept that instead of thinking.
Yeah, it's never in children's books anymore, but they were back in the old days, was the white bearded man in the sky. I wonder how long his beard was. And the white robes, and he was sitting up there.
That they're not supposed to cut their beard?
What?
It seems to me like there's somewhere in the Bible that it indicated that men were not supposed to cut their beard. Oh.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. There was some like John the Baptist was not, he was in a little group of